You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, this may come as a shock to some people, but we are not always in full control of our continued career success. What's that? We can't stay at the top of our games for as long as we want? No, our next guest says no matter how high your career peaks, they are that. They're peaks, heights, and they're going to be followed at some point by a decline. Well, that sounds kind of depressing, but it doesn't have to be if we're willing to change our mindset. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where are you in your career? How are you thinking about what's coming next? Have you made plans or have you fulfilled a plan to have a next chapter after your career, whatever it might have been? Or are you trying to figure that out right now? Are you over 50 and trying to figure out what you want to do when you grow up? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Arthur Brooks is William Henry Bloomberg Professor of the Practice of Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School and Professor of Management Practice at Harvard's Business School. He created the How to Build a Life column for The Atlantic. He's the author of a dozen books. His latest is called From Strength to Strength: Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. Arthur, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be with you.
Well, you did a lot of research in this book, but it started very personally for you. What got you started down this path?
You know, I've always thought, and you know, I'm a social scientist and I specialize in the science of happiness, but I was making this one mistake, which is I thought that successful people, they tend to wind up happier than people who haven't done as much with their lives. That people who do big things, you know, they can kind of dine out on it and feel good about it for the rest of their life. But I had this experience some years ago. I was on a plane and I was overhearing a conversation of an elderly couple behind me. And the husband was confessing to his wife that he might as well be dead, that nobody loved him anymore, and that, you know, people had forgotten him, and he was so depressed. And at the end of the flight, everybody stood up, and I turned around to get a look, and it was one of the most famous men in the world, somebody who had accomplished 10 times what I will ever accomplish in my career in my wildest dreams. And it made it clear to me that people struggle. And, you know, the truth is that people struggle more when they've done a lot and those things are finished. I went on to do a little study of how people get happier as they get older. And I found that about half of people get happier and happier from 70 on, and the other half start going back down. And so I started this study to say, what are the habits of the people who get happier as they age? And what can we do to remarkably change the odds of being happier at 75 than we were at 25? And this book is the result. It's the seven secrets, the seven habits of what people who get happier in old age, what they all do in common. I think I may have cracked the code.
One recurring theme in the book seems to be the things that might make us successful in the eyes of our peers or of the public don't always line up with the things that make us happy, especially in that later in life era. Why is that?
Well, one of the problems that we have in life is that we're always getting addicted to things that give us momentary satisfaction, whether it's cigarettes or drugs and alcohol or gambling. And one of the things that people who are really hard workers, who are strivers, you know, they've been told by their parents that they're the special one, that they can always do something better than others, is they become what I call success addicts. Success means you're kind of getting the cookie for doing the right thing, for working harder, for getting the grades, for accomplishing. And people get into this pattern quite early in life, and they pursue it well into their adulthood, you know, success to success to success. And it's like being on a treadmill, actually. A little tiny bit of satisfaction, then it wears off, and then there we go again. It's a very dangerous addiction. It's not the secret to doing well. And when inevitably your skills change, I mean, you said in the introduction to the segment that our skills decline, and they do. The problem is that we won't let things decline. We won't let things change. That one of the great secrets to people who actually get happier is that their early skills do decline, but a new set of skills appear if we're willing to let things go. We can be more successful later in life than we ever were earlier in life, but we have to let things go and let ourselves change.
You mentioned seven keys to finding that happiness later in life. We won't get to all of them today. I want to pick out one since I teased it a little bit there for people. The number one thing seems to be building good relationships. Easier said than done, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, it is. It's easier for some people than it is for others. But once again, we're talking about people who work very hard and try to do a lot with their lives. A lot of people who listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, let's not kid ourselves, who are, you know, doing a lot and they have good values and they're really hard workers. But the result is that they make some sacrifices. I've been working with people and teaching at the Harvard Business School. I see it all the time of people who basically think that if they get enough career success, then their relationships will take care of themselves. And of course they won't. The biggest problem that people have who are quite successful in life is that they have an enormous number of deal friends, but almost no real friends. And everybody listening to us knows the difference between real friends and deal friends. And so what I wind up doing in this book is talking about what the difference is and how people at any stage in life, at 25 or 45 or even 65, can start building a roster of real friends so they can have the satisfaction that they deserve later in life.
The tricky thing there is if you are thinking, I'm going to optimize my time for success, I'm going to get the most out of every moment, you write in the book, just hanging out with a buddy may not at any given moment feel like the optimal use of time. So it's going to be put off infinitely.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things that I find is that, you know, real success addicts, workaholic people, they tend to prioritize the 14th hour of work over the first hour with their families even. I mean, it's interesting. I was having a conversation over the course of writing the book with a very successful woman in New York City, a financier, a titan on Wall Street, who's made an enormous amount of money. And she's talking about all the things that are going wrong in her life, that, you know, she feels her skills starting to decline, but she doesn't have relationships very close with her adult children. Her marriage is kind of on the rocks. And I said, well, you're already telling me what you need to do. You need to step back from work and repair these relationships. Why don't you do that? She said, I guess I'd prefer to be special than happy. In other words, she was making a decision that to say that she would, you know, anybody can hang out with their family, but not everybody can run this enormous firm. And she had been making an affirmative decision. This is what all kinds of addicts do. We do this all the time. It's a bad trade.
We're talking to Arthur Brooks about his new book, From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Bennett is with us in Madison. Bennett, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think that the way this was introduced was a little misleading, and I want to say that just because I agree with the principles that, you know, being a workaholic is not conducive to, you know, gaining happiness throughout life. But I think that as much as you can control your mindset surrounding, you know, what defines your happiness, success can be a healthy contribution to that, and you don't really have to like look at a peak in your career as a peak in your career. You know, you're the one who decides when you've peaked and when you want to, you know, utilize new skills to maybe go a different route with your career or what you define as success.
And Bennett, can I ask, if it's not too personal, how old are you?
I'm 24.
Okay. So you're looking at this from the low end. I love that. Thanks a lot for calling in, Bennett, at 800-642-1234. Arthur, what do you think? We can,
well,
as long as we define
insight.
Our peaks. Yeah.
Yeah, no, Bennett's got a good insight. And in point of fact, what's happening through Bennett's 20s, going in 20s and even 30s is an increase in what's called fluid intelligence. You get better and better at what you do. You can work harder and get a big return from it. That fluid intelligence, from the ability to solve problems, usually to answer the questions that other people pose to you, that tends to start decreasing in your late 30s all the way through your 40s. But there's another kind of success that's behind it called your crystallized intelligence, your wisdom, your ability to not answer somebody else's questions, but to figure out what the right questions are, to build teams of people, to teach, to mentor. This gets incredibly strong as you go through your 50s and 60s and stays high in your 70s and 80s. What people don't do is they don't actually craft their life. They want to stay on that first curve because they were good at it, and they kind of rail against the world. They do what Dylan Thomas called rage against the dying of the light. And it's an exercise in futility. You got to be willing to change. That's one of the great secrets of happy people as they age.
Bennett, thanks for that call. Yeah, Arthur, chapter one in your book was about this inevitable decline and what you mentioned, that fluid intelligence. It was really kind of depressing. So I'm glad I kept reading to chapter two, this other kind of intelligence, that wisdom. How do we intentionally shift gears, though?
Well, to begin with, you got to know that second curve exists. A lot of people think that they get one curve. And for the longest time, psychologists talked about different kinds of genius, the early kind and the late kind. The early kind was, you know, sort of your Elon Musk type of genius, and everybody has it. This is not just about rich and famous people or people who are classified as geniuses as kids. Everybody has the capacity to work hard and to innovate and make something with their life. The second genius type that they talked about was kind of the Dalai Lama type of genius. You know, the wisdom, the people, the great sage, call it the David McCullough genius if you want. You know, the people who are able to take complex ideas and boil them down and explain them to others. Well, what we found out much more recently is everybody has both. The key thing is that you get one early and one late. And so the first thing that people need to keep in mind is that they have to trust that they have the second curve. But you can't get on the second curve until you get off the first curve. And that means you have to have confidence that it exists. You have to have the love of other people in your life so that as you start making changes, you don't feel like there's nothing out there for you. And this is one of the things that I talk about. I give basically step-by-step instructions in the book about how to go from one curve to the other.
We're talking with Arthur Brooks, professor of public leadership and management at Harvard. We're talking about his latest book. It's called From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you reinvent yourself, shift gears in your career, change your definition of success and happiness at some point? Or do you have questions for our guest about his work in this book? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with author, columnist, and professor Arthur Brooks about his new book, From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Has the definition of success changed for you over the course of your life, of your career? How about happiness? Can the two go together or do they run into each other? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Kevin is with us in Appleton. Kevin, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Kevin?
Well, you know, I think that, I've been working in the dairy industry for 32 years. It's kind of middle management jobs. Always trying to get more and more or better, the next step up, impress management, you know, and I put my family on the back burner. I went back to school, you know, I did stuff, and I kind of put my family on the back burner for a lot of years, and now I realize I should have done that. I mean, there where my happiness is.
Kevin, are you taking a second shot here and spending that time, spending that effort on your family now?
Yeah, I am actually, but unfortunately my arthritis and stuff prevents me from doing a lot of things I'd like to do.
Kevin, thanks for the call. Good luck to you in making this transition now. Arthur, what do you hear in Kevin's story there?
I think Kevin has actually got a lot. He's saying a lot of things that are absolutely right. But more importantly, I think it's incredibly encouraging because he actually recognized what the problem is. Most people, they feel a malaise. They feel a kind of a loneliness after they've been very successful for a long time and not paying adequate attention to the root systems, the real friendships and the family life that they need. Kevin figured it out, actually. And the result is I strongly suspect that he's going to have a lot of happy years ahead of him. One of the things that I talk to a lot to people who are making this transition to being happier as they age is there's a number of ways to increase the, let's just say that, to bring up the temperature on the family relationships and to actually create these kind of real friendships. And, you know, I've looked into the there's a large academic literature that talks about, you know, the best ways to do these things. Believe it or not, social psychologists have been talking about this for many, many years. And so through interviews and actually looking at the social psychological literature, I talk about the fastest way to do actually just that. But the first step, as Kevin suggests, is recognizing that you don't always make the right decisions. Now, the good news is you can always get on the right train. You can do it when you're 25. You can do it when you're 45. You can do it when you're 65. The key thing is actually doing it, repairing your relationships and growing in love. The happiest people are thinking about their faith and their family life and their friendship. And to the extent that they're really thinking about their work, which is important, is to earn their success, lift other people up, and to serve people who need them.
Kevin, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. A big point you make in the book, Arthur, is people need to know a change is coming. Some kind of decline in one set of skills is probably going to be on the way. And you You look at faith traditions around the world and talk about the idea of meditating on the fact that, hey, someday we're going to not do this anymore and people might forget about us. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
That's absolutely right. One of the reasons that a lot of people are unwilling to let the past go is because they're afraid. You know, fear is terrible. When I talk about love, I talk about love all the way through the book, because the truth is, I'm a professor teaching classes at happiness here in Harvard. And if you can boil down all the things that I teach at the Harvard Business School, is that happiness is love, full stop, basically. And I've got a ton of data to show that. The problem is that the opposite of love, the thing that crowds out love, is fear. People often think that the opposite of love is hatred. It's not. Hatred is downstream from fear. Anytime I find somebody who's lonely, find somebody who's having trouble finding love in their life, the first thing that I will start to investigate is the sources of their fear. And when we talk about these new stages of life, people are horribly afraid to actually lean into the weaknesses that they have, the strengths that they're actually starting to decline, so they can find the new strengths in their life. That's what the book is called, From Strength to Strength. So the one thing I recommend is that people meditate on the source of their fear. I was talking to my students at Harvard today about the fear of failure. I mean, so many of my students are deeply afraid of failing professionally, failing academically. And so the assignment that I give them is to meditate on what's the worst that can actually happen, to make it less scary, more ordinary, to have it become part of your familiarity. It's most likely not going to happen, but in certain cases, like your own death, there's nothing that you can do about it. You might as well get used to it. And you absolutely can. The Buddhists have been doing this for a couple thousand years, and we can do it too.
Talking to Arthur Brooks about his new book. It is called From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. Let's go back to your calls. Ronnie is with us in Cameron. Ronnie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I feel like in the first half, I did a fairly good job raising kids and finding my own satisfaction through teaching and managing Farm and Fleet stores. But now I'm in the second half, and I'm retired. I want to go back into production agriculture. I'm doing that, working a couple different jobs. But what I'm also finding is that I'm finding some resistance from my husband, who thinks that I'm not going to have enough saved up for retirement and this and that, and it's caused some conflict. And so I think having, you know, if you have a significant other, having both people agreeing with what the plan should be, and it does create some challenges. So I'd like to know what your guest has to say.
Ronnie, good luck with your new career. Arthur, what do you think?
Yeah, thanks, Ronnie, and good for you. I like to hear it, because you're jumping onto your second curve with both feet. One of the things that I recommend, so that people can be on the same page, you know, people who love each other, marriages, for example, that can really function as people change, is to be thinking about the fact that you're going to change and you should change together. Another way of thinking about this is to say, look, we have a 401k for our retirement, but we need a happiness 401k as well. And to make to set up ideas together, to plan out what we're going to do, so that together we can become happier people, and to make the investments that we actually need. What are the investments in our children? What are the investments in our friend group? What are the investments that we're going to make in each other's professional life, so that we can go from strength to strength? And when we see each other as fundamentally invested in each other's happiness, which, by the way, the one thing that all happy married couples have in common is they're working for each other's happiness. The best way to do that I've ever seen is to say, okay, what are the things that we need? What are the deposits that we need to put in our 401k together? And how are we going to do it?
Thanks for that call. Good luck negotiating that, Ronnie. Arthur, I wanted to talk to you about faith and spirituality. You talk in the book about your own Catholic faith. You also learn teachings from religions from India and China. What do you think about the role of faith and spirituality in negotiating this big change later in life?
Well, the role of faith can't be, it shouldn't be underestimated at any stage of life, actually. And this does not necessarily mean my faith. One of the things that I find and that I teach to my students is that the habits of the happiest people at every age, but especially as people get older, are basically fourfold. They're, as I mentioned before, faith, family, friendship, and work that serves other people. And when I say faith, I mean faith or even a non-religious tradition that kind of zooms out on life. And this is the key thing to keep in mind. one of the things that unhappy people have in common is they're very obsessed with the humdrum details of an ordinary life. My job, my car, my money, my friends, my this, that, and the other thing. And it's like watching the same boring television show over and over again. You're obsessed with it, but it can't really hold your interest in a meaningful, happy way. The great thing about studying the Stoic philosophers or developing a meditation practice or like me, you know, seriously practicing your Christian faith is what that does is it allows you to zoom out on life to see the adventure that actually is life in the transcendent. And everybody deserves to have that kind of adventure.
In our last minute or so, Arthur, can you leave people with maybe a first step to try to shift this mindset away from success and the importance of work to all the other stuff?
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing that I find about what all of the successful people have in common is that they have all the things and people and the transcendent in order in their lives. And so basically, this is the key thing to keep in mind. The world's formula for your happiness is all wrong. The world's formula is use people, love things, and worship yourself. And that's wrong. The real formula sounds like that. And so that's why the false formula kind of sounds right. The real formula is use things, love people, and worship the divine. If you follow that formula, you're going to be just fine.
Arthur, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Arthur Brooks, professor of leadership and management at Harvard University. We talked to him today about his latest book. It's called From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. Still time to share your story. If you are reinventing yourself in your career or figure out what the next step is right now, email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Consumer prices jumped 7.5% last month compared with a year earlier. That's the biggest increase in nearly 40 years. You might have noticed your grocery bill getting bigger, your paycheck not going as far as you used to. That's likely a consequence of inflation. The U.S. Federal Reserve is the main government agency tasked with controlling inflation. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell says supply chain issues are a big cause of the problem.
There's sort of a perfect storm of very strong demand and weak supply due to the reopening of the economy and various factors.
Our guest today says that's just part of the story. He says high inflation rates, there's a good chance they'll stick around for a while. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed higher prices at the grocery store or at the gas pump? Maybe you haven't noticed a change. Tell us about that. What questions do you have about the inflation we're seeing, when it might go down? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kevin Spellman is an investment coach and senior lecturer at the UW-Milwaukee's Lubar School of Business. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, I'm very glad to be here.
Before we get into causes and solutions, that part gets pretty complicated. A little more straightforward, I think, is the consequences of inflation. Can you talk about how it affects people in their daily lives?
Well, I mean, just if your costs are rising quicker than your wages, you know, obviously you can't spend as much. And over the last couple of years, prices on the consumer price index has risen about 3-4% more than wages. And it's even worse if you're not on the low end. If you're kind of a middle income worker, costs are rising much quicker than wages, and that basically lowers your standard of living.
That's the easy part. The harder part is the cost. Now, we heard there from the Federal Reserve Chair saying, hey, supply chain issues, a major culprit, maybe the main culprit. How big a factor do you see that that particular cause playing?
I believe the Fed is missing very much some long-term trends. So let me just back up just a little
bit.
You pointed out that inflation was 7.5% in January. The core, excluding food and energy, which is pretty volatile, was 6. The Fed originally said this inflation was transitory or temporary. They backed off that statement. This inflation surprise has been probably the biggest surprise for the Fed and economists in at least 30 years. If you're like me, you know, you think long ahead and you start thinking about some other long-term trends that are reversing. I sent you a list of 13 unlucky reasons that this is beyond supply chain. But should we start with the Fed's side of the story, and then we'll get to the other side?
Sure. Well, I mean, the Fed side saying that the supply chain issue, we've talked about that here on Central Time before. I am interested in hearing what are some of the core reasons that you think inflation was going to go up, maybe even without the whole supply chain kerfluffle?
Okay. So one of the big long-term trends that are reversing is the employer-worker relationship. Now, for decades, the workers have been losing out to the employer as their wages have not risen as much as productivity. And that's resulted in higher profits for corporations. Right now, it's exactly the opposite. A few years ago, it started with kind of more of a socialistic movement to higher wages. But right now, the workers are in the driver's seat. Last year, 47 million of about 150 million workers quit. Now, how could they quit? It's because there's other jobs. At the moment, there's 11 million openings, which is 5 million more than there are people unemployed. And the workers are demanding higher wages. And actually, they're probably on average unhappy that the wages are not going up as much as prices. Just one more thing to add to this about the lack of workers. We had about a million more people retire during COVID. We have several million lost workers from immigrants that work the farms. And we also have people out of work because they have COVID or, taking care of someone that has it. That's all resulted in, basically a lack of workers. If wages go up, corporate costs go up, which means they raise prices, which then workers demand higher wages, which means higher prices. So we got a wage price spiral like the 1970s.
Now, pretending for a moment that was the only part of the story, when does that settle down? What does it take to settle down that potential wage price spiral you were just talking about?
Well, in the 1970s, what didn't basically bring it back until basically the 1980s is an aggressive Fed that's raising interest rates. In order to, quell that trend, the Fed would have to raise interest rates quite a bit to slow the economy, which unfortunately means loss of jobs. But there are a few other things that could help out. One is the percent of the population that's actually participating in the labor force has gone down during COVID, and that could go back up. And obviously, people who are out of work from COVID, I said that's about a million, and they could, basically get back to work. So there's some other offsetting trends that could help out the worker situation. But we have unemployment at 4%. So we're really at a very strong employment base or unemployment rate right now.
I know some point toward government spending. We had big COVID relief packages, for example, the infrastructure bill money is getting into the economy now. How big a part of the story is that when it comes to inflation?
It's actually huge. So I basically say the Federal Reserve and the federal government, they have a job to do during recessions, and they did it well. Basically, they stimulated the economy. And I'll give you some more numbers to this in a second. But the problem is kind of like the good car that jumpstarts the bad car, the bad engine in the economy during recessions. But right now they're adding nitro to that engine and they're running it into a brick wall. Money supply is up over 40% the last 2 years. This money supply, this is, cash, coins, checks, money in the bank, up 40%, that needs to go someplace. And the Fed didn't think their quantitative easing that resulted in this money supply and the federal government with their stimulus plans would result in inflation because after the great financial crisis, they had about the same amount of growth in money supply and it didn't result in inflation. It's different this time. What's different this time is after the great financial crisis, consumers weren't spending because they had too much debt they had to save. Banks couldn't lend because they had to fix their balance sheet. At the moment, if you look at Federal Reserve surveys of bank lending, they're eager to lend. Consumers' financial conditions are basically fixed, and they're eager to borrow. If they borrow, then obviously they spend on units, and if there's not enough units on the shelves, prices go up. So I would argue that the government added nitro to that engine, and that's what's resulting in a lot of this inflation.
We're talking to Kevin Spellman, investment coach and senior lecturer for UW-Milwaukee School of Business. We're looking at the causes and the impacts of inflation and maybe some possible solutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question, a solution to propose, and what does inflation mean to you? Have you had a shockingly high blank bill? Fill in the blank there. Are you changing what you buy when you buy it because of high prices? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Kevin Spellman. Kevin has 30 years of experience analyzing, managing, and researching investments. He's a senior lecturer at the Lubar School of Business at UW-Milwaukee. We are talking about inflation rates, why they're high, where they're headed in the future, and what that means for you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeremy is with us in Appleton. Jeremy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Jeremy?
Well, I wanted to bring up the fact that I think it's not just inflation that is, you know, picking the consumer's wallet. I think that there is an aspect of corporate greed at this, where they're using the moment to increase their prices, because we're seeing massive increases in profits being reported by businesses, especially during Q4 of 2021. And now that we're seeing some of the financial reports for Q1 2022, you know, their profits are still high. So I think there's a lot of businesses that are taking advantage of this opportunity to raise prices and disguise it as inflation.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Kevin, I've seen people make that argument. What do you think?
I don't think it's really wrong. So it's part of the story. If there is not goods on the shelf, they can, you know, raise prices of it. Let me just throw in this. It used to be, the corporations have more profits now with fewer workers. So typically when you come out of recession, your productivity goes up because you delay hiring workers until you know you have the demand. But right now, their sales are back to basically trend, and they're able to produce, and that's what's driving up profits. One of the long-term trends that I thought was reversing is possibly the benefit of the internet. And there's an index out there. It's called the Digital Economy Index of Digital Purchasing Power. So long-term trend was, you know, we allow people to buy things on the internet, and that's reduced prices. What if corporations that are selling on the internet have now become so dominant, and I won't name the companies, that they become a little bit monopolistic, and they no longer have to lower prices, and they can even raise them?
Jeremy, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to key in on one particular cost, the cost of housing, something that we've talked about a fair amount, high rents, high prices for buying houses in many communities. How does that factor into this whole inflation story?
Well, in the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, more than a third of it on the core, this is excluding food and energy, is the cost of rent and housing. And that's another long-term trend that kept inflation down that's reversing. Over the last year, rents, at least according to some real estate investment trusts that I looked up, are up over 20%. Since 2019, they're up 10%. Now, how in the world could they be raising prices like this of rent? Well, first of all, occupancy is really high in apartments. So if occupancy is high, they can pass it along to the consumer. And second is, obviously everybody knows, housing prices are going way up. If housing prices are higher, then you can charge more for rents. And then the long-term trend that's reversing, post the great financial crisis, everybody wanted to save, so more people cohabitated. They didn't leave their parents' home, which means there was a lot fewer households as a percent of population after the great financial crisis. Now that everybody is, you know, making a whole bunch of money and back to work, everybody's leaving those homes and driving up demand for not just houses, but apartments. and driving up CPI. So this is a huge component of CPI, over a third, which is rising really quickly.
Earlier, you mentioned that list of issues you said along to us. I'm looking at number 13 here. What if Russia invades Ukraine and supply of oil and natural gas is curtailed? Well, Russia has invaded a chunk of Ukraine. Talk of embargoes, canceling or shutting down for now the idea of this new natural gas pipeline. What are you watching for that what if?
Well, it was my number 13 on my unlucky list why inflation could be higher. Oil prices are not a large part of inflation, but they're an extremely volatile component. And obviously, the price of oil influences all kinds of other things in the economy. Russia is a major producer of oil and natural gas around the world. So if the inventories are already tight of oil, oil went from negative during COVID to $91 a barrel. If it continues to go higher, that probably means inflation jumps further from here. Economists are probably expecting oil to come down and be, forced to bring inflation down. But if it's exactly opposite, it would drive inflation up further, which means the Fed also has to be more aggressive in raising interest rates.
Is that something that balances out because of increased production elsewhere?
Possibly OPEC could increase production. I think that's what we're referring to. And also the U.S. Oil companies, if you look at their capital spending plans for this year, I think they're up over 20%, which means they're going to drill and open up the spigot and add more supply of oil, which could help curtail some of the loss from Russia.
I'm hoping you could take a minute to put on your investment coach hat. What kind of things would people think about those with money to invest? What kind of things does inflation do to change the equation for them?
Okay, so my expertise is as an investment manager, and this is the hottest topic that people are talking about. So if you think about higher inflation, you're going to have higher interest rates. If you have higher interest rates, then it makes maybe less sense to invest in the stock market because your bonds are going to pay you more. So this is a very negative for the stock market. Also, higher interest rates slows the economy, which is also very negative for the stock market. The market is not prepared for this. There is various ratios of valuation that shows the stock market's at nearly at least a 20-year high in its valuation, which means it's pricing in for the Fed to be successful and bring down inflation. If it's not, that's very negative for the stock market. And you've already seen some of the weaker parts of the stock market, the money losing company IPOs, and all these other things are down 50% this year or from their highs.
In our last half a minute or so, what time horizon are you watching for, Kevin, to see inflation go down significantly?
Well, I do believe the supply chain issues will be somewhat fixed over the next year, so inflation could tame over the next 6-9 months. But long term, I believe the market's really not pricing in the fact that you could have higher than that 2% inflation for some time or years to come.
Kevin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Kevin Spellman is the Nicholas Director of Investment Management and a senior lecturer at the Lubar School of Business at UW-Milwaukee. He's also an investment coach. Kevin joined us for a look at inflation in the U.S. economy. The economic and social heart of Milwaukee's Black community was demolished by freeway construction in the 1960s. But years of redevelopment efforts are making some community members hopeful that the Bronzeville neighborhood could become a hub for Black culture again. Corrine Hess has more.
Located just 2 miles north of downtown Milwaukee, Bronzeville thrived for decades with vibrant small businesses and a nightlife that drew people across racial lines. Freeway construction in the 1960s meant the loss of more than 8,000 homes and churches, and the once tight-knit community scattered across Milwaukee. Artist Metope Johnson lived in Bronzeville until he was about 8 years old. Johnson is now in his late 60s, but he still remembers how vibrant of a community it once was.
So we could go to, you know, the grocery store, or we can go to the doctor. If the doctor didn't come to us, because the doctor actually came to visit you at your home.
Last spring, Johnson opened an art exhibit in Milwaukee detailing what old Bronzeville was like. And with new ethnic restaurants in the neighborhood and stores like the Bronzeville Collective, where 25 local vendors have opened shop, Johnson thinks some of the old vibrancy might be coming back.
What I've seen in the most recent years have really begun to pave the way for a huge improvement.
At the heart of the neighborhood is G's Clippers. Owner Gollin Smith was one of the first pioneers of the new Bronzeville when he moved to shop there in 2006. Walking into G's feels like stepping into another time period. Signs on the door caution guests to protect themselves against COVID-19, but inside, maskless people rap songs from another era. James Flippin has been a barber here for 5 years. He calls G's the neighborhood hangout.
This right here gives you a chance to come back into the inner city a little bit more, see a little bit more of what we have to offer.
In addition to the small black-owned businesses like G's, there are larger projects in the works. The Greater Milwaukee Foundation and the Medical College of Wisconsin are turning a former Gimbel's department store into offices and programming space. This week, America's Black Holocaust Museum will open after being closed for more than a decade. It was one of the only museums dedicated to telling the history of lynching in the United States when it closed in 2008. The museum was founded by lynching survivor James Cameron, who died at age 92 in 2006. One block over, a closed state office building is slated to be the new Bronzeville Center for the Arts, another anchor for the neighborhood. Artist Della Wells serves on the Arts Center board. She lived in Bronzeville as a child. She says over the years, some independent black artists and writers remained in Bronzeville, but this project will showcase black culture and give the artistic community another place to gather.
No one in Wisconsin is really, you know, talking about African-American art and art of the Afro-diaspora. By that, I mean the history of it. So we're going to take that mission on.
The momentum is drawing national attention to Bronzeville. Last month, the New York Times featured Bronzeville on its list of 52 places for a changed world. One of the people working behind the scenes is Deshea Gee, who recently led the neighborhood's business improvement district. Gee says people's mindset about the neighborhood's place in the city is changing.
It's just a place that has so much meaning, has so much history. It really inspires me to just keep going and know that there's more to do.
There are still empty lots and storefronts in Bronzeville, but people like Gee see it attracting diverse businesses and residents in one of the most segregated cities in the country, and again ready to make history. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.